Sunak's government faces a global headwind in the shape of stagflation, but also two homemade poisoned chalices, his and Johnson's previous flops. Of their most vaunted successes, both have flattened to deceive. The first in 2016 was the Brexit referendum. Winning 17 million votes, around a third of the electorate, represented the biggest Democratic vote in British history. Yet the Tory Brexit aim was to inaugurate a new economic growth model with new trade deals assisted by deregulation. This has not gone to plan, as a recent report by the House of Commons Public Accounts Committee makes clear. Britain's per capita GDP has risen less since 2016 than most of Europe and much less than US. Brexit, far from healing intra-Tory schisms, has deepened and multiplied them, including between the Austrian extreme centre Sunak and in the current Chancellor Jeremy Hunt and the populist right Johnson and Truss. Johnson and Sunak's other sham success was the response to COVID. They crow of having quickly purchased vaccines. Overall, however, they let the virus rip instincts that they both shared, compounded by glaring errors such as the nepotistic appointment of a hapless horse racing entrepreneur to head COVID test and trace, led to an abysmal record. The life expectancy of British people, especially in deprived neighbourhoods, slumped. Britain's COVID-caused excess mortality exceeds almost all nations of Western Europe and all the G7 countries, apart from the US. Long COVID continues to afflict around 2 million people, causing labour shortages and burdening the health system. Sunak has defeated Johnson thanks to a rule change stipulating that any prospective leader must secure at least 100 nominations from MPs. Johnson was barely able to secure half that figure. Where does this leave Sunak's government? The bleak fact is that Britain, experiencing eye-watering levels of poverty and chronic ill health, and now racked by a cost-of-living crisis, will re-commerce austerity mode. Its new leader is possibly the richest MP in history and certainly the only Prime Minister whose wealth exceeds that of the monarch. As a former hedge fund partner, he represents the most destabilizing form of finance. His wife belongs to the non-dom class, that is, the multimillionaires who are permitted to avoid paying tax on the vast bulk of their wealth and earnings. According to tax experts, Sunak has not been transparent with his finances, and his hedge fund background raises questions about his commitment to fighting tax avoidance. As Chancellor, he oversaw what is by some measures Britain's biggest ever rise in inequality. Hated by many in his party and lacking Johnson's charisma, he is set to oversee a final brief spell of Tory rule. At time of writing this article, the writer of the article said, they don't yet know his cabinet team, but they can predict that he will be flanked by Hunt, notorious for his role as useful idiot for Rupert Murdoch and for having inflicted ruin upon the National Health Service. In short, although Sunak inherits a substantial parliamentary majority, the Tory party is fractious and a substantial segment of MPs and members loathe him. Their majority is likely to disappear as soon as it's subjected to an electoral test. The main beneficiary of the Tory Omni shambles will be Labour. But here's the rub. Labour post-Corbyn has gravitated to the extreme center. Their leader, Keir Starmer, wishes to repeat the trick of three decades ago. On Black Wednesday of 1992, then-Tory government lost confidence of the markets and a sterling slumped. With the Tories branded financially inconsistent, Labour restyled itself New Labour. The party of sound finances, fiscal responsibility and centrist neoliberalism. Having ruthlessly purged his party of left-wing spirit with the sustained application of deceit, corruption and law-breaking, a major email leak has recently revealed Starmer's Labour can offer little but platitudes and market discipline. The aim is to manage the nation's finances in inclement times such that a little space for infrastructure spending can be found, which will rekindle upward circles of GDP growth. It's a bloodless pitch that stands a prospect of electoral success only through the opponent's ineptitude. The fundamental crises of social inequality and democratic decline from which the turbulence of Britain's politics stems would remain unaddressed. The very policies laid down under the last Labour government, including the empowerment of the Bank of England and the financial markets, are co-authors of the economic polarization, social fragmentation, and seething anger that lie behind the recent scenes of chaos at 10 Downing Street. Whether a Sunak premiership survives longer than a Truss, a Johnson or a Lettuce, the turbulence is set to continue in the Tory party.
Syria.
Part 2.
In Syria, I couldn't look the way I wanted to at the passing of 9 years as I passed the streets, alleyways, and buildings. I could only keep myself composed to some extent, as opposed to many others who were in shock and awe when they encountered these scenes. Especially when I saw all of those factories and workshops that used to be full of workers, engineers, and technicians 9 years ago. People who are no longer in their workplaces. Many people who are no longer with us. There's not enough space in the ground to hide their bodies. Sometimes a park in the street becomes their burial place. I felt that in Syria, I didn't have the right to speak of anything other than the war for the past 9 years. However, I decided to at least look for answers to why all of this happened in Syria. Why Syria? In the United States, people are not very political. Therefore, it really doesn't matter to them what happens in the rest of the world.
CBS News came to this place called Attaf with General Frank McKenzie, commander of U.S. forces in the Middle East.
David, we're standing on the Damascus-Baghdad highway, just inside Syria, and what we're doing here is supporting our partners in the fight against ISIS.
However, not all the people here are American. Some members of Syria's opposition visit the TANF base regularly. Apart from their looks and uniforms, they can be recognized by their Arabic language and their Toyota vans. It appears they are opposed to the Syrian government and have come together to fight the Syrian army. But it appears that their main mission after protecting the American base is controlling the roads that pass through Tanf. Of course, the Chinese, in cooperation with many other Asian countries, like Iran, intend to revive the Silk Road. This is a decision which is not secret, as they have talked about it openly on many occasions. Till then, the road linking Baghdad to Damascus, and from there to the Mediterranean coast, is still considered as the Silk Road. Wesley Clark is not the only person who believes the war in Syria was planned long before it started. Many others, like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., also share this belief. He is the nephew of the former President of the United States. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is both a lawyer and author, published an article in 2016 in Politico magazine entitled "Why Arabs Don't Want Us in Syria." The article stunned many. He writes, "In their view, our war against Bashar Assad did not begin with the peaceful civil protests of the Arab Spring in 2011. In their view, our war against Bashar Assad did not begin with the peaceful civil protests of the Arab Spring in 2011. Instead, it began in 2000, when Qatar proposed to construct a $10 billion, 1,500-kilometer pipeline through Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, and Turkey. To see whether Kennedy's claims are true or false, we go back to the year 2000. As you are aware, Russia is the biggest producer and exporter of natural gas, with Europe being its biggest customer. The Russians export 70% of their produced natural gas to Europe. The US is highly motivated as it tries to find an alternative to Russia's gas. As a result, they have turned to Qatar and Azerbaijan for gas. But the fact is that Europe's demand for gas could not be met via sea only, and that such a huge supply could only be sent to the continent through a pipeline. This was where the notion of the Qatari gas pipeline was put forth. That's the same energy transit route that would pass through Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Syria, and then reach Europe via Turkish terminals. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. writes, "In Putin's view, the Qatar pipeline is a NATO plot to change the status quo, deprive Russia of its only foothold in the Middle East, strangle the Russian economy, and end Russian leverage in the European energy market." This plan faced a big obstacle, the Syrian government. Elsewhere in his article, Kennedy writes, "In 2009, Syrians announced that they would refuse to sign the agreement to allow the pipeline to run through Syria to protect the interests of their Russian allies. They also announced commissioning of Russian-approved Islamic pipeline with cooperation from Iran and Iraq. This Islamic pipeline would transport Iran's gas to the Mediterranean through Iraq and Syria, with its final destination being West and Southwestern Europe. The project would become a huge source of revenue for Syria and Iraq, as well as Iran." As a result, all the three countries insisted on its execution. Now, there were problems. On the one hand, Qatar's gas could not be transferred via Syria. On the other hand, Iran would gain a foothold in the European energy market. That's why they decided to remove the problem, namely, the Syrian government.
This morning, President Obama called on Assad to step aside and announced the strongest set of sanctions to date targeting the Syrian government. These sanctions include the energy sector to increase pressure on the regime. The transition to democracy in Syria has begun, and it's time for Assad to get out of the way. As President Obama said this morning, no outside power can or should impose on this transition.
Cables released by the whistleblower organization WikiLeaks show that the Israeli, Saudi, and U.S. intelligence agencies started to give financial and intelligence assistance to the groups seeking to topple the Syrian government. This dates back to 2 years before the onset of protests in Syria. Regardless of the WikiLeaks cables, the most optimistic interpretation is that the 2011 protests over economic and political problems in Syria provided an opportunity to implement the Qatar gas pipeline to the Mediterranean by toppling the Assad government. Thus, the protests in Syria soon turned into a full-blown armed conflict, unlike Bahrain and Tunisia, where demonstrations remained peaceful. In a 2016 interview with an Italian news outlet, Bashar Assad explained the issue of the pipeline and the unfolding of the crisis in this way.
Many political analysts think the Syrian no to the pipeline routes proposed by Qatar may be one of the reasons why the war had begun in 2011. How important has been your no to Qatar in the beginning of the war?
It is one of the important factors that it wasn't offered to us publicly, but I think it was planned. There was two routes crossing Syria. One of them is north-south, which is related to Qatar, as you just mentioned, and the other one was east-west to the Mediterranean that crossed Iraq from Iran. And I don't think many countries who opposed the policy of Syria didn't want Syria to be a hub of power, of energy, whether electricity or oil, or even crossroads of railways and so on.
Later, in an interview with Russia Today, the WikiLeaks founder showed a cable that revealed Saudi Arabia and Qatar were providing military assistance to anti-government armed groups and even ISIS in Syria.
Early 2014 email from Hillary Clinton, so not so long after she left Secretary of State, to her campaign manager, John Podesta. That email, it states that ISIS, is funded by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, the governments of Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Now, I think this is the most significant email in the whole collection. And perhaps because Saudi and Qatari money is spread all over the place, including into many media institutions. Under Hillary Clinton, and our Clinton emails reveal significant discussion about it, the largest ever arms deal in the world was made with Saudi Arabia, more than $80 billion.
And of course, the consequence of that is that this notorious terrorist group called ISIL or ISIS is created largely with money from the very people who are giving money to the Clinton Foundation.
It's a belief, but thanks to Trump, we can believe much of these stuff. Do you remember when Donald Trump described ISIS as a creation of Obama and Clinton during his 2016 presidential campaign?
He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS. Okay? He's the founder. He founded ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton. Co-founder, crooked Hillary Clinton.
Another person who can easily answer these questions is Qatar's former Prime Minister, Hamad bin Jassim.
There's even questions have been raised about how much funding Qatar has done to some of the Islamic groups in Syria.
Look, in Syria, everybody did mistakes, including your country. When the war or the revolution happened in Syria, all of us worked through two operation rooms, one in Jordan and one in Turkey. The first one was in Jordan, and there was countries, some of the GCC countries, among them the Saudis, the Emiratis, Qatar, United States, and other ally. And they was working from there. And all of us, we was supporting the same group. In Turkey, we did the same. We discovered by the time, you supported wrong groups sometimes, sure. But you stop. It doesn't mean that we did not do something wrong there.
Whichever way you look at this story, the support of Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey of armed opposition forces in Syria is unequivocal. We should remember that in the U.S. gas project, the Turks and the Saudis would also receive hefty transit duties for allowing the pipeline pass through their territories. The Qataris themselves have admitted this. When relations between Qatar and Saudi Arabia soured, and the Saudis put Qatar under economic and political pressure, Qatari officials tried to place the blame for what happened in Syria on Riyadh. They were not aware that they were admitting to their role in the Syria crisis too.
And at the beginning, and I say this publicly, the beginning, we have the green light from King Abdullah, late King Abdullah, that we lead and they will support us in this. And that was a discussion direct with King Abdullah. And then they tried to, later they want to change their opinion. They should inform us. We don't mind to be in the back seat and they
wanted
the
to
lead.
Take the lead?
Yeah, we don't mind they take the lead. They are the biggest, big country. We choose to be there because they don't want to appear in the beginning that they are, you know, completely involved. It was easy to change the regime first year.
Easy.
Easy, because there was no Russian completely involvement, no Iranian.
There were accusations that Qatar funded al-Nusra, which was linked to al-Qaeda. This happened, yes.
I don't think we have a relation with somebody which United States and all the other ally does not know about it.
In the midst of all this, leaders of some terrorist groups would make statements that would serve as a clue for smart people. Like this one. One of the most prominent propaganda leaders of Jabhat al-Nusra, who was critical of Saudi Arabia for sanctioning Qatar, believes the Qataris were among the biggest supporters of the Syrian opposition from the beginning. The city of the Silk Road and Qatar's pipeline project are not the only reasons for the war on Syria. Just look for US military bases in Syria other than Tanf. From the onset of the war in Syria, all US military bases other than Tanf were established in the country's north and northeast. At the time, the US set up the bases under the pretext of helping Syrian Kurds in the face of attacks by terrorist groups, especially ISIS. The Kurds were content with the US military bases and rejected help from the Syrian army, But in 2019, Trump suddenly announced he was withdrawing U.S. forces from Syria. However, it was later revealed that the United States was not only planning to pull out their troops, but intended to beef up their military presence in places like Tanf.
But we are leaving soldiers to secure the oil. Now, we may have to fight for the oil. It's okay. Maybe somebody else wants the oil, in which case they have a hell of a fight. But there's massive amounts of oil, and we're securing it for a couple of reasons. Number one, it stops ISIS, because ISIS got tremendous wealth from that oil. We have taken it. It's secured. Number two, and again, somebody else may claim it, but either we'll negotiate a deal with whoever's claiming it, if we think it's fair, or we will militarily stop them very quickly. We have tremendous power in that part of the world. We have, you know, the airport is right nearby. A very big, very monstrous, very very powerful airport, and very expensive airport that was built years ago. We're in that Middle East now for $8 trillion. So we don't want to be...
Let's take a look at this map. Nearly all U.S. military bases are close to Syria's oil-rich areas. Trump justifies the U.S. encircling and extortion of these oil wells by claiming that the United States spent $8 trillion. During his presidency, Trump has frequently vowed to pull out U.S. forces from the Middle East, most particularly Syria. But in the same period, the U.S. has built six new bases in northeast Syria.
And one of the things that was brought out by the media, actually, and wisely and correctly brought out, we have very few boats going there anymore because we have our own oil and gas. We don't need it from the Middle East anymore. And that's why we're pursuing a future not only of energy independence, but not just words. You know, you've been hearing energy independence for years and years, and you'd hear it. We have real independence. But what we want now is not independence. We want American energy dominance. Dominance.
All this constitutes only part of the economic motive for Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the United States to wage a war on Syria. Now the key question is, in light of all the proof, should we keep on thinking that the war in Syria is nothing but an ethno-religious conflict? What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight. In the U.S., House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul Pelosi, has been attacked at their California home with a hammer. The attacker has been identified as 42-year-old David DePape. DePape will be charged with attempted homicide, among other charges, according to San Francisco police. A motive for the attack is still unknown. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. The British newspaper The Guardian has more on this story. Paul Pelosi, husband of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, was hospitalized with a skull fracture on Friday, 28th of October, after he was attacked at the couple's home in California with a hammer by an assailant who was reported to have shouted, "Where is Nancy? Where is Nancy?" Paul Pelosi, an 82-year-old, underwent successful surgery to repair a skull fracture and other serious injuries sustained during the assault, and is expected to make a full recovery, according to Nancy Pelosi's spokesperson, Drew Hamill. Earlier, on Friday morning, Paul Pelosi was attacked at home by an assailant who acted with force and threatened his life while demanding to see the Speaker of the House. Drew Hamill said in a statement on Friday afternoon, 28th of October, San Francisco police said that Paul Pelosi managed to call 911 but didn't directly report what was happening, but that a dispatcher sent police officers to follow up with a well-being check at about 2:27 a.m. local time in the early hours of Friday morning. They found an adult male confronting Paul Pelosi, and a hammer was being grasped by both men. The suspect pulled the hammer away from Pelosi and violently assaulted him with it. Our officers immediately tackled the suspect, disarmed him, took him into custody, said Bill Scott, the chief of the San Francisco Police Department. Bill Scott named the suspect as David DePape, a 42-year-old, and said he broke in through a back door. Charges are to be brought at the San Francisco County Jail, including attempted homicide, assault with a deadly weapon, abuse of an elderly person, burglary, and other felonies. David DePape remained in the hospital on Friday evening, but the San Francisco Police Chief Bill Scott did not disclose his condition. Scott said police were still investigating the motive for the attack, but said this was not a random act, this was intentional. It was reported by CNN that the suspect intended to tie the victim up until Nancy Pelosi got home, and that he had posted right-wing and conspiracy theories online, including content promoting the lie that former President Donald Trump was deprived of victory in the 2020 presidential election because of voter fraud. In a statement to CNN, an acquaintance of David DePape said he appeared to be out of touch with reality. Two of the suspect's relatives also told the network that DePape, who grew up in British Columbia, Canada, was estranged from his family. In addition to multiple conspiracy posts on his Facebook account, which was reviewed by CNN and later taken down by Meta on Friday, David DePape is also believed to have managed a blog to which he regularly posted screeds concerning the ruling class. The blog, which the San Francisco Chronicle reviewed and was later taken down, had a banner that said, "Welcome to Big Brother's censorship hell," along with numerous conspiracy posts about the U.S. government, media outlets, and technology companies. President Joe Biden called the attack on Paul Pelosi despicable and denounced people who spread lies about stolen elections for corroding the political climate in America and contributing to politically motivated violence. "Enough is enough," Joe Biden told supporters at a Democratic Party fundraiser in Philadelphia on Friday, 28th of October. "Every person of good conscience needs to clearly and unambiguously stand up against the violence in our politics, regardless of what your politics are. Democracy is literally not figuratively, on the ballot this year, said Joe Biden, who warned about the dangers of extremism in an impassioned speech in Philadelphia last month. The president said reports indicated the attack on Paul Pelosi was aimed at Nancy Pelosi and noted that the suspected assailant used the same chant, "Where is Nancy?" heard from supporters of former President Donald Trump when they stormed the U.S. Capitol building on 6th of January 2021. Joe Biden said it was not surprising that one party's repeated lies about stolen elections could affect people who may not be so well-balanced. According to the Associated Press, the attacker had specifically targeted the Pelosi family home. Video footage of the house showed glass shattered in a side entrance, indicating where the break-in may have occurred. A person briefed on the situation told the Associated Press that the intruder had confronted Paul Pelosi while demanding to know where his wife was. The speaker, who is second in line to succeed the president, was not at home at the time of the attack, but was in Washington, D.C. with security protection that accompanies her at all times. The website of NBC News has more details for us. San Francisco's district attorney said they expect to file attempted murder and other charges against the man accused of attacking Paul Pelosi with a hammer at his home on Friday, 28th of October. Anytime you strike someone in the head in the fashion that Mr. Pelosi was hit, it is clear to us that he was attempting to kill him, district attorney Brooke Jenkins told NBC Bay Area on Friday evening. She told the station her office expects to file charges of attempted murder, residential burglary, abuse of an elderly person, and assault with a deadly weapon. The suspect, David DePape, is accused of breaking into the Pelosi home and striking Paul Pelosi, the husband of Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, at least once with a hammer. Paul Pelosi, an 82-year-old, underwent surgery for a skull fracture and is now recovering, a spokesman for Nancy Pelosi has confirmed. San Francisco Police Chief Bill Scott said the attack was intentional and not a random act. A motive in the assault has not been released. David DePape was in hospital on Friday, 28th of October, but will be booked one way or the other, either in person or in absentia, Bill Scott said. Meanwhile, Representative Benny Thompson, the chairman of the House panel investigating the January 6th Capitol riot, called the attack on Paul Pelosi abhorrent and urged his congressional colleagues to reject divisive conspiracy theories that he said have fueled violence. Unfortunately, the attack against Paul Pelosi appears to be a symptom of a much larger problem within our democracy, said Benny Thompson, Democrat from Mississippi. He added, in recent years, we have seen a rise in domestic terrorism fueled in part by violent, racist, anti-Semitic and anti-democratic rhetoric. Benny Thompson cited the deadly 2017 white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, and the Capitol riot of 6th of January 2021 as examples of how armed attackers have used violence to impose their views. So-called vigilantes have been intimidating voters at ballot drop boxes and harassing local election officials. America is better than this, Benny Thompson added. I call on my colleagues in Congress and elected officials across the nation to put country over party and reject the conspiracy theories that are proving so divisive, despite any perceived political advantage, Benny Thompson said. Thompson, who also chairs the House Committee on Homeland Security, called on federal agencies and law enforcement to reinforce efforts to protect officials and elections as the midterm elections approach.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
On the last day of September, Burkina Faso military leader President Paul Henri Damiba was deposed in the country's second coup in a year as Army Captain Ibrahim Traore took charge of the restive West African nation. Now, the coup was welcomed by many in the streets of the country's capital, Ouagadougou.
We are in the streets not because we support a coup or encourage it, but to find unity and truth. We are here to support our military, to find peace, because we have suffered so much at the hands of terrorists.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on the recent coup in Burkina Faso, which came amid an upsurge of terrorist attacks. The people of Burkina Faso, just like many in neighboring West African countries, believe that former colonial power France is responsible for the current insecurity across the region. Our expert will be giving us her take on the reasons for the coup in Burkina Faso. The second part of our program today will be on condescending remarks by the United States climate envoy John Kerry, who is demanding that African countries should not invest in long-term gas projects.
The struggle in Burkina Faso. Burkina Faso Army Captain Ibrahim Traoré has ousted military leader Lieutenant Colonel Paul Henri Damiba in what marks the second coup in the West African country this year. According to a statement read on national TV on 30th of September, Traoré and a group of officers deposed Damiba, dissolved the government, and suspended the constitution and transitional charter.
Traoré said the officers who helped Damiba seize power in January had decided to remove their leader due to his inability to deal with the insurgent groups, including some associated with Al-Qaeda and Daesh. A Burkina Faso military spokesman is seen here making the coup announcement.
Our common ideal was betrayed by our leader, Lieutenant Colonel Paul Henri Damiba, in whom we had placed all our trust. Indeed, the deterioration of the security situation, which justified our action, has been relegated to the background in favor of unfortunate political adventures.
Well, to discuss the recent military coup in Burkina Faso, we contacted Ms. Inem Richardson. She's an organizer with All African People's Revolutionary Party. She's also the co-founder of the Thomas Sankara Center for African Liberation and Unity. Thanks a lot, madam, for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm always happy to be on.
Now, what really led to the latest coup in Burkina Faso just months after another military takeover?
Well, I think if we look at the context behind this coup and the last one, we see that the original coup against Damiba was actually quite popular at first. People came out largely in support of it, because the hope was that Damiba would follow the direction that Mali took and divorce Burkina Faso from France and French domination, as well as from Western control in general. That was very much the desire of the people on the ground and why people wanted the coup in the first place. After a long period of time, people began to see that there was not much of a difference in terms of how France's relationship with Burkina Faso materialized or existed on the ground, as well as how the Damiba administration was approaching the security situation in the Sahel region and the border region with Mali. So there was an increased, over time, discontent with Damiba.
The dramatic takeover, which ended with ousted military leader fleeing to neighboring Togo, coincided with violent anti-French protests and the sudden emergence of Russian flags among demonstrators. The army officers who seized power in Burkina Faso say toppled military leader Paul Henri Damiba is planning a counter-offensive from a French base. Protesters have come out in support of the new military leader, while condemning the ousted ruler, who they accused of being a puppet of France.
Traoré! Capitaine! Traoré! Capitaine! Damiba is pro-français.
Damiba is pro-French. He has destroyed Burkina Faso. But thanks to God, we have a great strong man like Ibrahim Traoré to save us all.
Protesters in Burkina Faso have openly expressed support for Russia. Burkina Faso is now turning into a theater of struggle for control between Russia and France and the West in general.
I think, you know, Burkina Faso and this whole region of the Sahel in general is beyond a theater of struggle between Russia and the West. I think this is also a region where there's a heightened dissatisfaction with a long neocolonial system that has been run by France and French allies like the United States and the other NATO countries for a very, very long time. So we see not just here in Burkina Faso, but also we've mentioned Mali, but we can talk about Chad, we can talk about protests in Niger, we can even talk about protests in Senegal. We see this whole movement trying to get France out of the Sahel.
Now, we have seen protesters expressing displeasure with the regional bloc ECOWAS after military takeovers in West Africa. Now, is ECOWAS realistic in its approach to coups in the region?
You know, I think that there's a lot of hypocrisy within ECOWAS right now. You know, we understand that the goal of ECOWAS and what it promotes are what they claim to be free and fair elections, a certain style of democracy that is encouraged in the region. But we also see some of these people who are taking the most anti-coup stances, like out of Senegal and out of Cote d'Ivoire, for example, who are also constantly under surveillance by the people themselves because of this constant threat of taking illegal third mandates, unconstitutional third mandates to stay in power and to prolong their own positions. So there's kind of this hypocrisy where, on the one hand, ECOWAS is very pro sort of this Western style bourgeois democracy, but on the other hand, also violates that whenever it's convenient for certain neo-colonial factors to stay in power. What is really damaging on ECOWAS's part are when the sanctions are issued in cases like what happened against Mali, because that's not even just targeting the Malian government, that's hurting the people.
The recent events in Burkina Faso are almost similar to what happened in neighboring Mali, where anti-French sentiments run high. The government in Mali believes France is still interfering in the internal affairs of this country, including backing terrorist groups.
I really encourage everybody who is listening to this to go and listen to what Prime Minister Maiga said at the United Nations General Assembly. The accusations against France by the Malian authorities are really quite grave, really quite serious. Beyond just supporting the former president of Mali, we are hearing about the violation of Malian airspace with drones and fighter jets. We are hearing accusations that France has supplied terrorist organizations with arms and ammunition, as well as intelligence information. There was support on France's part of ECOWAS sanctions against Mali as a result of the anti-French government that's currently in power and currently seized power.
According to the Global Terrorism Index 2022, the Sahel is home to the world's fastest growing and most deadly terrorist groups. Now, how will the instability in Burkina Faso impact on the regional struggle against terrorism in the wider Sahel region?
Well, I think more and more people are understanding that this question of terrorism and this question of neocolonialism are not separate questions, but we have to understand what the roots are of terrorist activity is in this region of the world. I already mentioned the way that the NATO invasion of Libya impacted the Sahel. That led to a huge availability of arms flowing into the direction of the Sahel region. And this is something that people are increasingly aware of. And then, you know, we are talking about the role of France in also helping to sustain some of this terrorist activity, according to what the Malian authorities are currently alleging. And so I think that, you know, there's different ways to look at this question. Stability, we see this as typically a positive thing, but we have to understand that you know, stability is not always necessarily positive. If it's necessary to disrupt the system that exists a little bit for a period of time, if that means some form of instability, as long as we can bring that to a place of organization and to a popular form of government, then that's welcome. But what's not welcome is a very stable, long-term neo-colonial system that completely exploits the African people for the benefit of France and for the benefit of Europe.
Well, our guest there says instability, which ushers in a popular government, is preferable than a stable neo-colonial system. I'd like to thank Inem Richardson for her incisive analysis today. We shall now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the patronizing remarks by the U.S. climate envoy, which angered many in Africa. Stay with us.
Kerry angers Africa. You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
United States climate envoy John Kerry has angered many in Africa after arrogantly stating that African countries should not invest in long-term gas projects in the continent. Speaking on the sidelines of an African government ministers' conference in Dakar, Senegal last month, Kerry claimed the world is transitioning to renewable energy and that will not be in the interest of Africa investing in gas projects.
Gas replaces coal or replaces oil. That's good. But after 2030, it's going to be important to be able to capture the emissions from gas, too.
Now, to discuss these annoying remarks by John Kerry, we have contacted Tunde Osazua, who is an African team member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, can we say the assertion by Kerry that Africa should not invest in long-term gas projects is condescending and imperialistic?
I think so. Especially since Kerry is representing the U.S. imperialist state. U.S. imperialism is the greatest threat to life on the planet. It's a force of ecological devastation and disaster. It impacts not only human beings, but also our non-human neighbors and relatives. In fact, you know, the U.S. military is the largest force of ecological devastation that the world has ever known. It's, you know, been robbed through atomic bombs, toxic waste, and untreated sewage that's been dumped by over 800 military bases in over 80 countries. The U.S. Department of Defense actually consumes more oil than any institution in the world. And in the year 2017 alone, the U.S. military emitted 59 million metric tons of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, which is a carbon footprint greater than of most nations worldwide.
Mohammed Ibrahim, a leading African philanthropist, accused developed countries of hypocrisy in warning Africans against developing natural gas reserves while also eyeing such investments in response to the energy crisis in Europe.
Europe is wallowing in gas. Germany uses a lot of gas. Russian gas, actually half of African gas is exported to Europe. And then we have 600 million people without power. And people say, no. You cannot use gas here. This is morally bankrupt. It's just, that's immoral.
Many African analysts have echoed Mohamed Ibrahim's sentiments, saying efforts by Western powers to restrict fossil fuel investments in Africa are the height of hypocrisy.
It's the height of hypocrisy, those efforts to restrict fossil fuel investments in Africa, since many of the wealthy countries behind those efforts, like the United States, the United Kingdom, and France, include natural gas in their own multi-decade plans to transition to clean energy. Belgium, for example, has doubled its natural gas usage since 1990 and has plans to build even more gas to power capacity in the coming years.
While Africa has contributed negligibly to the changing climate with just about 2-3% of global emissions, it stands out disproportionately as the most vulnerable region in the world. Now, this is while, according to Carbon Brief's analysis, the United States is the highest contributor to cumulative carbon dioxide emissions in the world since 1850. Now, Kerry denied that the West and developed nations bear responsibility for climate change and urged every country to bear the burden of its impacts. How true is this statement?
It's not very true. The African continent and much of the third world is already bearing the brunt of climate change, while much of the West, is relatively protected in some cases, right? And the African continent hardly produces any greenhouse gases despite all of that. African people and Africa's non-human inhabitants are paying a heavy price for the environmental crimes of foreign lands like the U.S., like, you know, France and the U.K. and Japan and others. One resident of the United States has the same climate footprint as 27.5 Senegalese people.
The West is insisting that Africa forgoes the gas, oil, and coal at its disposal due to climate change. Uganda President Yoweri Museveni, speaking recently at the country's independence celebrations, slammed European Union Parliament for demanding that the country should halt its East Africa crude oil pipeline project.
Recently, there was yet another manifestation of imperialistic arrogance and hegemonism by elements in the European Parliament, whereby they decreed from Brussels that East African crude pipeline should not be constructed until those arrogant actors permit us to do so.
The insistence by U.S. climate envoy John Kerry and the EU Parliament that African countries should halt their fossil fuel development projects is seen by many as a deliberate attempt by Western countries to prevent Africa's industrialization, which will eventually stop over-reliance to the West.
I think we should note that it's not just industrialization that caused climate change. It's really the extractive practices of multinational corporations, largely based in the West, and the devastation of, you know, Western militaries, and particularly those like the U.S. military that brought about climate change. And so the false narrative that, you know, the West is trying to push helps them argue that Africa and a lot of the third world should forgo industrialization. And that's basically a death sentence for African countries.
Delegates from over 50 countries participated in a pre-COP27 meeting held in Kinshasa, the capital city of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Climate activists praised the progress made and want to make sure that previous promises are kept. The country's environment minister said that Africa must be allowed to exploit its resources.
The 2022 United Nations Climate Change Conference, more commonly referred to as the COP27 Summit, will be held at Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, in November. Now, what's your projection on this meeting? Are we going to see major split between the West and Africa?
And the success of that domination has always depended on the complicity of an intermediate class